WPFW, Washington.
Good evening and welcome to the Raucous Caucus, live now. Live at Ben's Next Door. Next door to Ben's Chili Bowl, 12th and June. Mark, Terry, and Garland, three minds linked and locked in analysis, wit, and sagacity. Every Tuesday night, live. Live right here, 7 p.m., WPFW, 89.3 FM. Welcome. Again, live with Terry, Mark, and Garland, and the Raucous Caucus.
Good evening, and welcome to the Raucous Caucus. I am Mark Levine, sitting here with
Terry D. Kester.
And we are missing Garland tonight.
Oh, we miss him terribly.
He is in North Carolina, and so that wonderful voice of reason that usually sits between Terry and me is gone.
Oh, we're in trouble.
That means we may be even more raucous tonight.
I feel danger. I really do.
Two very different topics tonight, both in the news, both very important. One dealing with domestic policy, one dealing with foreign policy. The domestic issue is what we're going to do if we need
we
to
should
do
mention
anything.
Where, invite people down, though, before we get
yes,
to the
we should. We are at Ben's. Yes. Ben's next door, 1211 U Street.
1211 U Street.
And it's right next door to Ben's Chili Bowl.
In the mezzanine. Come on upstairs.
Right across from the U Street Metro, if you would travel by Metro. And if you're listening in your car, there's still plenty of seats open.
Yeah,
you can come, you can join us, and you can opine on either one of my topics tonight. One is deficit reduction. Is it necessary? And if it is necessary, what do we think of the plan of Congressman Ryan, the Republican plan? What do we think of President Obama's plan? And perhaps you have a plan of your own. And the second topic in the second half hour, completely different topic, a foreign policy topic. What the heck are we doing in Libya? How's it going? Should we do more? Should we do less? And should we do anything about Syria, which is having a brutal crackdown of its own? So two very different topics. As I said, you're welcome to join us at Ben's Next Door. Join Terry and me and give us your 2 cents. If not, you're going to hear from us.
2 cents ain't going to cut it for the deficit, though. You've got to get a little more riled up than that, you know?
So let's start with talking about the deficit. Now,
It's a phony issue, but go ahead.
Well, I am a firm believer that in times of economic recession, it is the worst time to cut the deficit.
And history proves that.
Well, the history that's very clear is the time of the Great Depression. Herbert Hoover believed in the 1920s, after 1929, after that crash, that the best thing to do was to raise taxes and cut spending. And so he did that. And he turned a bad recession into the Great Depression.
Yeah, and there was actually some stimulus going, money going on as the market started to collapse, and they canceled that.
Because
the same thing that the Republicans are asking to do now.
Right. So what John Maynard Keynes taught in the 1930s is now considered classical economics. You can take economics and you can take it in college, you can take it in high school, you can take it in your community center. They will tell you really something that shouldn't surprise you. I mean, frankly, Joseph knew it in the Bible when he had his dream for the Pharaoh. Remember that dream about the seven fat cows and the seven thin cows?
Yeah,
and basically the dream is in good times, you store enough away so that in bad times, you spend it. Now, of course, in the O's in the last decade, in the Bush decade, what happened? Well, we had a decent economy, not a great economy, but one where the wealthy were doing fabulous. The middle class and the poor not doing so well. And in any case, the Bush administration said, and to quote Dick Cheney, deficits don't matter.
Hey, I got the article right here. You got the same article?
Oh, I don't, but go ahead.
You want to do the same research?
No, I mean, it's a fact.
Deficits don't matter. But let's just destroy one myth before we continue. One myth. The Republicans and everybody keeps on campaigning on the issue and the idea, well, this is any way you could run your household, it wouldn't possibly work. And this is no way to run a business because it couldn't possibly work. This is not about your personal debt. It is not about this. It is not the same thing as household debt. It is not the same thing as corporate debt. The big difference is, very simplistically, is the government creates money.
Yes,
you don't create money. Corporations don't create money. Only the government does. It's a different issue economically entirely.
But let me say this, Terry, and this, whenever I say this in a mixed audience or to a various networks, I get a good laugh out of conservatives. They don't believe me. But the truth is, and this may shock you, that I am a fiscal conservative in the sense that I believe in normal times, when unemployment is low, when the economy is good, we should actually run a balanced budget or even a surplus. I think Bill Clinton was absolutely right in the 1990s to run that surplus. He used that money, in fact, to pay down, to give money to Social Security Trust Fund, to give them back money, to extend Social Security's solvency from 2028 to 2042. When unemployment is low, there is nothing wrong with a surplus. There's nothing wrong with a balanced budget. I agree.
May I quote?
I agree that in the very, very long term, a debt is bad. But I recognize that there are times to spend and times to save.
There are.
Unemployment is 9%. It's a time to spend.
But when you got into conservative, being conservative, I think we've got to clear up that. Well, I'm going to quote here from Mariner Eccles, who was the governor of the Federal Reserve Board in, I believe, Kansas City, I think it is. Anyway, he's one of the 12 governors there. And I'm quoting here from an article in Huffington Post from Ellen Brown, and she's quoting him in a moment. Under our current monetary scheme, debt and deficits not only don't matter, but are actually, and this is the key, necessary in order to maintain a stable money supply. This was explained by Mariner Eccles, who I just mentioned, governor of the Federal Reserve Board, in hearings before the House Committee on Banking and Currency way back in 1941. Wright Patman asked Eccles how the Federal Reserve got the money to buy government bonds. "We created it," Eccles replied. "Out of what?" "Out of the right to issue credit money. And there is nothing behind it there except our government credit? That's what our money system is," Eccles replied. "If there were no debts in our money system, there wouldn't be any money. We create the money."
That's true, Terry, but I remember very clearly in 2001. 2001, it's 10 years ago, but I think for some people it seems like a century ago. In 2001, we had year after year of record surpluses. Mm-hmm. We had more surpluses than we'd ever had at any time in American history. And we were paying down the debt. We were rapidly paying down the debt.
But we still had debt.
And I remember very clearly.
And we still had deficit.
Because we had surpluses in 1999 and 2000.
But
we had a debt.
But that didn't eliminate the debt.
No, it did not eliminate the debt. You had this debt.
The debt is part. Debt is not bad.
Let me finish. So I remember we had this debt. We had this massive debt. Yeah. And we started paying it down. 98, 99, 2000. Every year a surplus. Every year we were paying down the debt. And Alan Greenspan, to his everlasting shame, and I was working in Congress at the time in 2001, testified in 2001 on behalf of the Bush tax cuts. And he said, and it's not a quote, but it's pretty close to a paraphrase, "I am worried. I am worried that our surpluses are so large that we are going to end up paying down the entire national debt, and then where will we put all the money? I'm so concerned. What will the government do with all this excess money?" And I remember thinking, well, they could just give it back to the taxpayers. But he said, "No, I don't know. Do we buy stocks? Do we buy bonds? Buy bonds. We need these tax cuts."
So you're disagreeing
because
with Governor
Eccles? We're so rich.
You're saying we can eliminate debt? This is a myth.
Let me finish, Terry.
You're confusing us here. We don't need to eliminate debt. We don't need to eliminate the deficit. That's the key point to understand.
My point is that Alan Greenspan was a little optimistic when he thought we were going to end the national debt.
Yeah, we've never been without national debt.
No, we have never been without national debt. But it doesn't hurt to pay it down when times are good. And in Bill Clinton in the 98, 99, 2000, times were good.
But you
it's
don't
okay
eliminate
to pay it down.
It's key to understand that we, you don't eliminate it. If you eliminate it, you freeze the economic system. You cannot do that.
We weren't going to eliminate it, but it's really easy.
So, but I mean, there's no real reason to pay it down except for the interest that you're paying on it, which is a concern. But other than that, the debt itself and deficit, it does not, as Dick Cheney says, as Eccles says, as Randall Ray, a great economist, says, it does not matter.
Terry, the deficit does matter.
Why?
But it matters.
Only in the psychology of the people, but go ahead.
No,
why economically does it matter?
There's a range. Now, I agree that in the short run, in a time of economic recession, that is when you need a deficit. No question, deficits are good now. But if you go back to the Clinton years, 98, 99, 2000, I'm glad we had a surplus. Where did that money go? Well, half of it went to shoring up Social Security. That's good, right? We had a strong economy, If the debt gets too large.
We had a strong economy except for the fact that the middle class was losing ground back then. And the
they
very
were doing,
rich,
they did much
the
better.
The very rich were getting richer and richer. That goes all
they
the way back to the Clinton
years. They did much better in the 90s than they did in the O's.
No, they have not made a net gain since 1976, and you know that.
I know they have declined since 76, yeah. but I yeah. also know that the 90s were far better to the
for
middle
a certain
class.
Group.
No.
And the only reason the 90s
were better than the
80s. Because we transferred the debt to the individual. And that's the mistake that was made in this country. And that's why we had the crash that we did. Because the debt was put on the back of Americans. Individual Americans, the homeowners.
Here's the
that's
point.
That's what went wrong.
It is true.
It's not federal debt.
It
it's
is
a different
true
issue.
That in the long run, there is a limit to how much debt we can undergo. All right? And right now, in fact, the highest national debt that the United States has ever had was during World War II.
World War II,
and
yeah,
we ran about 130% of our gross domestic product, something
yeah,
like that.
And it didn't wreck
and
the country,
we're closing, we're closing in on 100 now. We've got mm-hmm. about 90 some odd. But my point is that it goes back to the Bible. In good times, you pay down the debt. In bad times, you need to increase the debt. You need to increase government spending. So the problem is that the Republicans have a different view. Their view is when we're in power, we want to increase the debt, and when we're not in power, we want to decrease the debt, because they know when they're in power, they can do things like give giveaways to oil companies and pharmaceutical companies and double the military, actually more than double military spending. And when Democrats are in power, they want to do things like health care and education and Medicare and giving student loans and environmental concerns, all the things Republicans don't want. So while Cheney will tell you deficits don't matter when he's in power, when Obama's in power, then they'll come out with deficits do matter. The answer is not, I want deficits when my party's in power and I don't want them when the other party's in power. The answer is you need deficits in bad times, you need to spend in bad times, you need to save in good times.
You need both debt and deficits in our monetary system.
You don't
system.
Need deficits. Did the economy collapse in 98, 99, 2000 when we had surpluses? The economy didn't collapse. Deficits are not required. A well, debt is required, you're saying.
Are you talking about creating more deficit or eliminating deficit? The deficit wasn't eliminated.
The debt was... Okay, let's get some terms down.
Yeah, let's get some terms
all
right,
right
there. Yeah, it was not eliminated.
A surplus means that in any given year...
We're taking in more tax money than we're...
The yeah, government takes in
it.
More
that's
revenues
it
than it spends. A deficit means, in any given year, the government spends out more than it takes in. Deficits and surpluses are measured on an annual basis.
Right, but that,
national
doesn't have anything to do with what the Treasury is necessarily doing.
The national debt is an accumulation of every surplus and every deficit mm-hmm. the United States has had from 1789 to today.
But we cannot talk about this as if this is a matter that really somehow there has to balance in order for our economic system to work, because in fact our economic system works with an imbalance and always has.
The point is, Terry,
and this whole crusade about this by the Republicans is in fact an economic lie.
Well, it is a charade.
Yeah.
Because as I said, when they were in power, they wanted to spend out the wazoo.
Yeah, but see, people... No, but that's not it. See, people are still thinking if I spend $2 and I've only got $1, the government's going to fall apart. That's not true.
It is.
I may fall apart economically if I spend $2 and I've only got $1, but the economy that I have to deal with an individual or even a corporation has to deal with is not the same as a government, which is the only entity that can, in fact, create.
You're right.
Create money. It creates the money.
Terry, you're right.
And it creates the debt and it manages debt. And it creates a deficit and it manages a deficit. These are not bad things.
Terry, you're right that the government can run a debt. You're right that we have run
always
a debt
has.
Every year from Revolutionary War bonds
you better
till
believe
today.
It.
However, there is a limit to how much debt we can run. The limit
the
is
limit.
Not how much money we can print. We can print an unlimited
and the
amount.
Limit.
Oh, let me make
yeah.
my point.
Okay, no.
The limit
okay.
is not the amount of
you're
money
wrong,
we can print.
Ahead.
Yeah, we could print an unlimited amount of money. At some point, if we got to, for example, twice the gross domestic product, at some point, people will stop buying our bonds because they're afraid
exactly.
we're not going to be able to pay it back.
Okay, that's the point.
That's what happened to Greece.
That's the point, but you see, this...
That's the point where it gets to be too much.
I mean, I'm not crazy about the empire, as you know, but we're talking about the empire here, and we're talking about... You know, this is not Greece. This is not Portugal. This
That's
is not
true.
Italy. This is not Ireland. yes, there may be some imaginary point. Nobody knows what that point is. There might be some point when the debt or the deficit is too large, and therefore we put ourselves in a dangerous financial position. But we still are today the economic power of the world.
No question about it.
And we are not in economic danger.
We agree that in bad times we need to spend.
Yes, we do.
It sounds to me, though, like you're saying that you're against the surpluses of the late Clinton
years. No, I'm just trying to dispense with the illusion that the only viable thing for a government is to have some kind of balance like a household must have.
Well, of course, I agree with you.
And it is not. That is not necessary.
That's certainly true.
We're always going to have debt.
That's true.
Is going to go up and down and up and down. That's perfectly fine.
But once
the interest we're paying on the debt's another issue.
And it goes higher. And in fact,
there's another issue.
As President Obama pointed out.
Because that has to do with the international markets and everything else.
As President Obama pointed out in his speech, he said if we go at these same rates to 2022, all of the money paid by taxpayers will go just to the interest on the debt.
That would be bad.
Unless
we just change the damn tax code so that we got a little more taxes
from
the super rich.
Which brings us to the question of what to do in the long term about the national debt.
One, accept that it exists and understand that it exists and it's okay.
Terry, no one is saying there should be no national debt. Right?
That's the illusion.
That's why I was making fun of Alan Greenspan.
That's the illusion.
Now let's move on past that.
Okay.
Because the question is, I think we can agree, or at least economists will tell you, that in good times when unemployment is low, it's good to pay down that debt.
Yeah.
So the question is not at this point to pay it down, but where the money should come from. Where do we get the money to pay it down? We can agree it shouldn't be done in a recession. But assuming the economy improves in 2012 and 2013 and 2014, where should the money come from? Now, Congressman Ryan, on behalf of the Republican Party, has issued a manifesto. And I think that's probably the best way to call it.
It's a plan, whether you like it or not.
It's more than a plan. It is a radical restructuring of the entire American social system.
And to some degree economic.
He would end Medicare. Mm-hmm. Completely end the guarantee that you can get medical care and make it private. He would.
Privatization works so well. We've seen that in the housing market. But go ahead.
He would end Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
He would cut transportation 25% at a time when our bridges.
Even if you were using his words, you would say he would change those. He's not eliminating them.
Well, he does. Let's talk about Medicaid. Talk about Medicare. He wants to eliminate, right now, Medicare. If you are 65, you get Medicare.
Yep.
You get treatment. You get Part A. You've put your money in the system, and it comes back to you, and you get treatment. That's the plan. Mm-hmm. Paul Ryan and the Republican Party would end that plan. They say, if you're 55 now and you get to be 65, good luck. We're going to give you a coupon. It'll give you $1 off at Denny's, and it'll give you $10 off your doctor's bill. Other than that, we want all the money to go to health insurance companies who would come back in the market.
Well, the insurance companies have done so well. You know that.
And they could charge whatever they wanted. And according to the Congressional Budget Office, the insurance companies would charge almost twice as much as is charged today under Medicare. And Paul Ryan wants to increase. Today, seniors pay about 25% of what the total cost. Under Medicare, he would increase that to 2/3.
Okay,
instead of 25 out of 100, it's 2/3 out of 200, which is, if I do my math right, 133. He would increase your Medicare payments more than 5 times. And most of the money would go to the health insurance companies. That's the Ryan plan.
Let's agree, before we get too carried away on it, that the Ryan plan is destructive to the social fabric of this country.
And would be very expensive.
But the question you asked is, how do we solve this illusionary problem that we have?
I'm not willing to accept it's an entirely illusion. I'm not.
Okay.
I think it's a long-term problem, not a short-term problem. How are we going to solve it? Well, I would solve it.
There's only one way.
In many of the ways that Obama talked about, but there's several ways. Let me give you my full plan, because I have a lot of them. Number one. The defense budget has gone up 120% in the last 10 years.
Oh, we love defense.
It has more than doubled.
We love the military.
And only half of that increase has anything to do with Afghanistan and Iraq. I would cut the defense budget dramatically. I think we were fine in 2000. We can go back to those 2000 levels. We got to bring the troops home from Iraq and Afghanistan.
Now you say you would.
That's a lot of money.
You're saying you're asking Congress to cut the military budget.
Absolutely.
And Congress has done this how often?
Not very often.
Yeah. And they've changed their entire motivation because...
Let me give you the rest of my plan.
Okay.
I would
one ain't going to work, but go ahead.
I would raise taxes.
I would raise taxes on
those people.
Now you got it.
That earn more than $250,000 a year, millionaires and billionaires. And I wouldn't just raise income taxes. In fact, I think income taxes are the least amount needing of raising. That can be raised 3%. Capital gains taxes, interest taxes, estate taxes, all the taxes. It's, to me, I have this crazy idea, Terry, that if you work hard, you should get more than if you sit back with your money in the bank and earn interest. Than if you sit back and your great uncle dies and gives you money as part of his inheritance. To me, hard-working money should be taxed at a lesser rate than what we call, I don't know, sitting on your rear-end money, which, as you now know, capital gains, maximum tax rate, 15%.
15%.
Interest, dividends, 15%. And you know, the fact that hedge fund managers only pay 15%.
Well,
but that's not all, folks. I'm going to give you all my savings.
One more, okay.
I would cut agricultural subsidies to rich farmers. I would cut subsidies to oil companies.
I would cut subsidies to
pharmaceutical companies. I would cut out all of that corporate welfare, and I think you would find substantial savings in the Mark Levin plan.
And how has Congress done so far with this?
First, let me hear the Terry Kester plan.
Well, now you and I disagree on a very fundamental level that we were having this wonderful dinner with our special guests tonight, Jim Biggis and Kathleen. Thank you so much for joining us. They contributed to WPFW.
Got dinner with us.
We contributed a dinner to them, and they wore us out and made Mark and I argue. So
which
we're exhausted.
Never happens in real life.
Yeah, it's the first time. You know, we normally don't do that. But anyway, my different point of view from yours. Yours is what you call pragmatic.
That's right. I believe I am a pragmatist.
Yes, no, but you call yourself a pragmatist.
I do call myself that.
You know, and you actually believe.
And you call yourself a revolutionary?
Yes.
Okay.
But more than that, I call myself someone who's aware of cultural trends and cultural motivations. And I think those are what are essential. And
I don't listen to Lindsay Lohan and Charlie Sheen like you do.
And that's where leadership has to come in, and where leadership has been failing in this country for the last couple of decades, if not longer.
So that means you can explain Donald Trump? Wow.
You're aware of cultural trends?
Yes,
I can. Of course I can.
Oh,
you explain Donald Trump, it's celebrityism. What more do you want?
Exactly. All right, let's hear the Terry Kester plan.
You have to teach the people, if possible. You know, we have this illusion in this country that somehow their taxes are bad. That's nonsense. That is absolutely nonsense.
Good luck convincing Americans that taxes are good.
No. You have to admit that your plan, Congress has made every one of those points over the last, I don't know, 2,000 years, however long Congress has been around.
It hasn't been 2,000 years.
It feels like it. Believe me, it feels like it.
And only you've been around 2,000 years.
Well, that's how I know. You know. And they have done nothing. They have done nothing in terms of farm subsidies. They have done nothing in terms of, you know, raising the taxes on the rich. They've done none of the stuff you've talked about.
Bill Clinton raised taxes on the rich in 1993.
They're not going to.
No, wait. Bill Clinton raised taxes on the rich in 1993.
Oh, a smidgen. It didn't even matter.
3%,
you know,
something.
And then Reagan and everybody else, Reagan has taken away so entirely. But the point is, you, one, have to say to the people, look, Obama's done one good thing in his presidency so far as I'm concerned. One really good thing, and I wish he would stick to it because it's essential. And he simply said, this is not about money. This is about what kind of country you want this to be.
That's true.
And that is the essential cultural, emotional issue out of which pragmatic solutions can arrive if we accept, get into that debate. Do we want a country that just abandons the poor people and the sick people, as we essentially do now? Do we want a country that just abandons people who can't get medical insurance? Is that what Americans are as human beings? That's the debate we have to have.
There are people
and
that
if you start that debate and saying, who are you as an individual? Who are you as an American? Who do you want to be? Do you care about your brothers, your sisters, your cousins, your neighbors? And if you start that debate, then you say, okay, do you understand? Then in order to support a system that is, in fact, caring, which we claim we are, that is, in fact, that even goes so far to say Christian or Judaic or Islamic. If you're going to call yourself those kind of people, then you have to raise money from the people to help the people.
But Terry,
that's
called taxation.
It's a good thing, not a bad thing. It's a good thing. And once you begin to realize that and understand that the purpose of taxes is to build the kind of country you want, you change the focus. Now, if you stick to raising taxes just so you have military, so you can wage war in every damn country you feel like it, then you got a problem.
Terry, those are your values.
Yeah.
But many people in America.
I've got to leave this damn country again.
Will tell you they have different values. They'll tell you, I don't want to give money so that other person gets health care.
They're going to call me a
commie. I
want
to give money because
right?
I like to blow up things.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I want to give money because I want to go to the military.
Let's assume you're true. Right.
What if that person who I don't know dies of lack of health care?
And if you're
it's
right,
not my kid.
And if you're right, and that's the way the American
some
feels.
Some people feel that way.
Then somebody in leadership, and I believe the president, and I believe senators, and those who have leadership culturally and politically, have to start changing the conversation. Because if they don't change the conversation, none of the ideas that you are talking about are going to happen.
You know what I think, Terry? I think some of this, there's an underlying racial bias. I think for the white working class people in America,
I don't disagree with that.
A lot of them will actually vote for policies that harm themselves.
Sure.
As long as it doesn't help, sorry to say it, black people.
Well, you brought up.
I think that there is still.
There's that. And there's
Jim
that.
Mentioned the article by Harold Meyerson in the Washington Post talking about we're still fighting the Civil War. And what happened in the Civil War? You had the plantation class in the South, and they got poor white people that didn't own slaves because they wanted to feel better than black people to fight for the rich plantation's interests.
And you
they're still doing that.
But understand again that this gets back to my basic point, and Ann Hornaday made a great comment about it, about the new film about Lincoln made by Robert Redford. You know, it's still, we have this cultural thing of glamorizing the South.
The you mean way the antebellum South, or you mean today's
the
South?
The antebellum South, yes. You know, the grand old mansions, Gone with the Wind. Not Gone with the Wind. What am I trying to think of? The Great Civil War.
Could be Gone with the Wind.
Yeah, whatever.
But there's a certain glamour in Gone with the Wind.
Yeah, we glamorize the South in the antebellum life. Now, when do you see the Union side glamorized
in any
way whatsoever?
You know, I can't think of that.
No.
Yeah, no, I can't think of
that. The film has never been made. You know.
Well, it's just like Friday. Apparently, two kids in England are getting married, and a whole bunch of people are making a big deal out of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it may be because, I don't know, they're royalty or something. That's the glamour, right? It's a glamour of wealth and inherited privilege.
You're right.
And oh, the joy of not having to work, and oh, the joy of having servants take care of it. You know what it is? It's a wannabe. People glamorize it because they never imagine themselves as slaves. They imagine themselves as Scarlett O'Hara, right? They glamorize the royalty. They don't imagine themselves as the king's butler. They imagine themselves as kings. And they put themselves in that fantasy world, and that's where the glamour comes from. We have to take a break.
Oh, no.
We do?
Not yet.
We do?
Oh.
And then we're going to move on after the break to talking about foreign policy.
Oh, no.
If you want
finished.
To join us, come on down to Ben's Next Door, 1213 U Street, and try to get a word in edgewise between Terry and me. We'll be right back.
Plenty of room. Plenty of room.
After this.
Hi, I'm Andy Shalal, owner of Busboys and Poets and Edenville Restaurants in the District and Virginia. Please make a generous contribution to your Jazz and Justice station. Writers like Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurston are my inspiration. An institution such as WPFW keeps the invaluable contributions of these and other writers alive. As another prominent native son, Duke Ellington, would say, a new world a-comin'. Here at WPFW, we are helping to shape that new world. Call 202-588-9739. Please make a generous contribution to your Jazz and Justice station, and thanks for your support.
Into the night and back to the Raucous Caucus.
Back to the Raucous Caucus.
Are we back?
Welcome back. We are back at Ben's Next Door.
Are we both back?
come join us, please. This is Mark Levine. I'm sitting here with
Terry D. Kester, the doctor of democracy.
Garland Nixon, our voice of reason and moderation, is gone tonight. It's just Terry and me sniping at each other. But hey, you know, we do it with Garland
we're creating.
We could do it without him as well.
We're creating, Mark.
We are broadcasting the Raucous Caucus live, as we do every second, fourth, and fifth Tuesday of the month. So every other Tuesday. We are broadcasting live from Ben's Next Door. It's right next door to Ben's Chili Bowl, 1213 U Street. There is still time if you're driving around. Just stop by and check out some of the good food here and check out Terry and me in person.
And stop by and point out to Mark that I am right and that Mark doesn't quite understand the issues.
And you can stand up to the mic and tell Terry why he's so wrong. So, Terry, I want to move on about foreign policy, but I know you got one more thing. You've been dying
one
to
more
say
thing. One more
about
thing.
Our past topic, and then I want to move on to Libya and Syria. But
it's
go ahead.
And it gives away my age to somewhat degree. You know, but
103?
Somewhere around there, yeah. But the other real problem in this country, and all these problems are, in fact, culturally linked, and that has to be recognized, is there was a time in this country, short-lived, to be sure, but there was a time when the worker, in general, was respected. Particularly after World War II, and yes, I'm post-World War II. But during the 50s,
I would say from the 30s well into the 70s.
Yeah, and I mean, even with the union troubles and everything else, there was a time when, you know, workers were the citizens of America. And there was a time
the salt of the earth.
And part of it was also simply because of World War II and because of the draft. And you had worker, you know, had the guy from the country serving with the guy from the city and the guy from the corporation serving with the guy from the farm. You had this.
And you had the GI Bill, so they could all go to college when they came back.
Yeah, the GI Bill, and they went to school together, and they found out, geez, there's just human beings. During that time period, we didn't have this illusion that we have now that we really want to be aristocracy, and we really want to be rich, 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 rich. And that whole concept of respect between people and workers has disappeared. We don't respect. I mean, we actually talk about people having dead-end jobs. Now, can you imagine that back in that period of time of anybody saying that any job is a dead-end job? Of course not, because you respected the person having the job.
Well, some people had some bad jobs. I'll just say this. I think there's no problem with Americans wanting to be rich. It's part of our capitalist system.
If it's their goal, they're losing sight of social responsibility.
But it's no shame to be poor either, and there are plenty
That's
of
right.
rich people who are patriotic enough that they believe in giving back to their country. There are rich people out there, not all of them, but there are some, who believe in John F. Kennedy's words, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. And we should allow rich people to be patriotic and to contribute back to the country that has given them so much by paying their fair
and
share in taxes.
And we should realize, too, that every hard-working American, by their effort and by their work and by their contribution, is essentially patriotic.
That's true.
And that's all it takes. It doesn't mean you have to wave a flag and scream.
That's true.
It doesn't mean you have to join the army. It means you just have to be part of society and contribute. That's all it is.
Give back to society that gave you so much.
That's right.
I want to talk about two societies that aren't working very well right now.
America?
We just talked about America.
Okay.
Let's go halfway around the globe.
All right, around the world.
And talk about two countries, one in which the United States is involved, however more or less we'll talk about, and one where we're starting, perhaps, to get involved. One is the country of Libya. The other is the country of Syria. Now, if you've been following the news, you know that neither country is doing very well right now. We'll take them one at a time, but I'm sure we'll compare in a minute. Libya, the rebels, as I don't like to call them the rebels. I think I'll call them the people of Libya, who are fighting to overturn their dictator. The people of Benghazi are stuck. They keep going down a line between, if you've been watching as I have, Adjabja.
I didn't even interrupt you. How could you
and
get
Basra,
distracted?
And Brega, that line doesn't move much. They haven't advanced much. And then right now, as we speak, the people of Misrata, very brave people, they don't have any much arms backing them up, are being brutalized. Gaddafi's military is shelling homes, killing children, literally lobbing missiles, rockets into people's homes indiscriminately. And the people there are very brave, and they're fighting. They even managed to use sand trucks to block the main roads at great risk to their lives so they couldn't get enough weapons to the people in that tall insurance tower and actually manage to defeat some of Gaddafi's forces. Literally, sand-beating tanks. And, of course, the United States is helping somewhat. NATO is helping somewhat. And the question is, what should we do next? Then there's the question of Syria. Doc. But let's start with Libya. Terry, what do you feel when you see those people in Misurata?
I am, and pardon the pause, there's somebody said...
Call it Misurata, like misery.
I can't remember who right now, but somebody, Rogers, pointed out that war feeds on itself. And one of the more basic and true concepts describing war. I think, unfortunately, we as a country, there's three different issues, there's many different issues, there's 1,000 different issues, but we as a country are really caught in a no-win situation. This is not, it is a civil war that's going on in these countries to some degree or another. Civil wars are, of course, the ugliest, even though we're celebrating and glamorizing our own civil war. Civil wars are hell because you are killing brothers and sisters and friends and neighbors and everything else. And somehow or other we have perpetuated or seem to be perpetuating these civil wars around the world.
Wait. We are perpetuating this? You blame the United States for this?
At the moment we are. At the moment we are.
So you would have preferred... Now, we talked before this happened.
No, we talked before this happened, Terry.
And you didn't want to intervene, and I admit
I didn't want to intervene. I didn't want to intervene for only one reason. Two reasons. America is filled still, no matter how many Vietnams we go through, filled with military hubris that we can walk in and solve problems in other nations. And we can do it because we're good and because we're great and we've got the best weapons of anybody. And we make this constant mistake and getting ourselves embroiled in things where we don't have a vision, they don't have a vision, and somehow there we expect this to somehow there become something that's positive.
Well, now here's
or
the
good.
Thing. President,
I mean, I don't know exactly what the answer is. I do know that jumping in there with military might and saying, "Oh, we're going to clean this up in a couple weeks," is childish.
But that's not
and
what
foolish.
President Obama did. President Obama,
you say
advocated
that we committed
a very
military.
Limited,
yeah.
measures.
That's
what did
like,
he do?
That's like saying, "I'm going to punch you. You're going to punch me, and we're not going to punch anymore."
What he did is he brought in planes. He took out some targets. The immediate measure was to save the people of Benghazi from a massacre. At one time, I think a week later, you were okay with that. You've kind of changed your view a little bit back and forth. That's okay. That's your right. You're an American. But then we basically stopped. We said, okay, the Brits and the French, you care more about Libya than we do. It's more your interests. It's more your oil. You go at it. Go ahead, Britain. Go ahead, France. Go ahead, NATO. You're in charge.
You know what bothers me, Mark?
And
anything else. We don't play the game even honestly.
They're not achieving.
I am not a warmonger in any sense, but if this were really something that were really about saving humanity, if that's what it really were about, and if we really were trying to protect the Libyan people, and if that's really what it was about, then yes, we should have blown Gaddafi's headquarters and home to smithereens on day one. And
well,
just said
you
that's
and I
it.
Agree on that.
Just say that's it. Because the
you
game,
and I agree on that.
The game we play now, if, oh, we're not asking for a regime change, but Gaddafi's got to go.
You're right.
I mean, who are we kidding?
Well,
and
the purpose of that is to keep the international coalition together.
Yeah, right.
But no, I agree. I think we need to go in there, we need to take out his tanks, and we need to let the people of Misurata survive. And I don't think it'll cost that much money. I don't think we need troops on the ground.
On the other hand, I do think, though...
They want our help, and they should get it.
Even now, in Egypt, this is astounding. I don't know if you saw this.
I did see it. I brought the same newspaper.
In Egypt, which is a country that's not having near the turmoil that Libya is having. And
it had 18 days of turmoil and just a few hundred deaths.
Yeah, and
compared
they're supposedly
to the
moving
thousands
towards some kind
Libya.
Of democracy or some kind of reform.
We'll see.
79% of the Egyptians at this point do not have a favorable opinion of the United States.
But Terry, let me think about why that
they
is.
They do not want United States involved in their politics.
That's
do they
right.
have confidence in President Obama? Over 60% have no confidence in President Obama.
So why are we? I think it was.
Not too much and
not
none at
all.
Not
too much and none at all. Right.
It's not too positive, you know. They got more faith in the Raucous Caucus than they got in President Obama.
We haven't broadcast in Egypt yet.
We will.
Terry, let me suggest to you that one of the reasons why the Egyptians don't have confidence in the United States is because we propped up Mubarak for years and years and decades and decades and only backed away from him at the very last minute. Let me suggest to you that Libya can be different. That in Libya, people themselves asked for our intervention before we intervened. They begged us for our intervention. The Arab League voted for our intervention.
Some of them did.
The people of Benghazi, I didn't hear too many calling for us not to intervene. I don't hear too many voices of free Libyans telling us they didn't want us to be there.
And you're going to try to tell me that it's only mercenaries that are fighting for Gaddafi?
I think it's largely... I'll tell you who's fighting for Gaddafi. Some of it's mercenaries.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it is his own personal tribe, which is by far a minority.
And a lot
of it is people who are corrupted by the system and, frankly, have a lot to lose because they have blood on their hands and they don't commit more blood. They know that when the people of Libya are free, they're going to get theirs. I think the vast majority of the people of Libya do not want Gaddafi there. And it is my hope, and call me naive if you want, that if we help the people of Libya win their revolution the way we didn't really help the people of Egypt very much, that the polls of Libyans after that are going to be very different from the polls of Egyptians you just read.
You know, maybe the major flaw, and I hate to even say this, but I just wonder historically, who exactly was our ally during our civil war? Nobody.
Yeah.
Russia.
Russia
is shattered from the crowd. There was a little help.
Actually,
the Confederacy traded with England for a little while, and then they stopped.
The empires, the powers, said we can't get in this.
I don't think of Libya as a civil war.
And I really don't. I really wonder.
I don't consider it a civil war. When people are fighting to oppose a dictator.
They know that we create the mess that allows these dictators to get power, to stay in power, to gain power. We, being the empire, create these.
Libya was never part of our empire.
Libya was part of our oil needs.
Not really.
Even though most
of Libyan oil went to Italy and France.
Yes, but you see, it goes to Italy and France, and therefore, you know, they don't have to get the oil we want from Saudi Arabia and Iraq.
You think this is a war over oil? Because I don't. And I thought the war in Iraq was about oil, and I opposed the war in Iraq from the get-go. Do you think the Libyan war is about oil? I don't.
It has that component in it.
You can't
sit on 2% of the world's oil and it not be important.
Well, let me ask you about a country that doesn't have hardly any oil, at least no oil that I'm aware of. That country is called Syria.
Yeah, notice we're not doing anything there.
Well, let's talk about that.
Yeah.
Syria
is
now massacring about 100 people a day.
Yeah, or more.
Probably more. And for those that know Syrian history, they know that in 1982, the fourth largest city in Syria used to exist. It was called Hama, H-A-M-A. It was the fourth largest city in Syria. In 1982, they revolted against Assad, the current president's father. And Assad decided that Hama would cease to exist. So he went in. He murdered, some say 25,000, some say 40,000. He murdered tens of thousands of people. He literally took the city off the map. He burned down all the buildings. He demolished every one of them. Today, Hama is a desert. It does not exist.
Okay.
And it was a very clear message to the people of Syria, don't mess with me, we will massacre you all. So now, an incredible thing is happening. 30 years later, one generation later, the people of Syria are again, very nervously, very scaredly,
very courageously,
extremely courageously, are taking to the streets. And what's Assad doing? The son, of course, he's going and he's...
The son that we've supported and thought would be a reformer,
by
the way.
We didn't really support.
Well, we opened diplomatic relations,
and the people who thought... Yeah, well, you're right about that.
Yeah.
And I think the first thing we should do, and I think Obama's getting there, The first thing we should do is end diplomatic relations with Syria. That's a tiny thing, but we got to do it. Already Obama is telling non-essential embassy personnel to get out. In a couple of days, I hope he tells the embassy to get out. Let's get all the Americans out of there. That's number one. Number two, he's talking about sanctions. I think we need sanctions. Syria gets a lot from Europe. He has to work with Europeans. From today's Washington Post, it looks to me like Obama is starting to take at least the minimum necessary steps, and I hope you agree.
Why
with
do you say they're necessary?
Why is it necessary to close down diplomatic relations and have sanctions against Syria? Because I don't think we should ever be having diplomatic relations with a country that is killing 100 of its own citizens every day.
Does that include China?
You know,
and we're caught in our own hypocrisy. I mean, I don't.
Well, but China's a lot more powerful country than Syria. Look,
yeah, right.
China,
exactly.
China. Look, I have no one has more sympathy for the Tibetan people than I do.
Yeah.
I believe Tibet should be free.
Yeah.
I think they're. I mean, Tibetan Buddhists are non-violent pacifists.
Ask about the Falun Gong in China and how many of those have been
killed.
Or
about Tiananmen Square. The problem is that Syria is a country that, through our actions, we can still have an effect on.
I don't know. I mean,
I don't think we can have that effect on China.
I don't pretend and mark this.
And I don't know that China's killing 100 people a day either in terms of civilians.
No, I don't have a good answer to this, and I don't think anybody does from Obama up and down. You know, I don't think there is a good answer. I do say this. Our country has been, you know, again, it has to do with what I consider diagnosis of who we are. We have been a hypocritical country for decades. And we keep on getting caught in our own hypocrisy. We claim to be one thing. We claim to be for freedom and democracy. At the same time, we'll support any damn dictator that has any commodity that we want. And then when things get a little rocky, we say, oh, we're on the side of freedom, but we're not going to really do anything about it unless we really gain something about it. We are caught in a situation now that could turn into, and maybe it's necessary and maybe it's just the way history has to evolve, but we could have in Egypt, in Syria, in Yemen, in
Bahrain,
Iraq,
Iran,
Afghanistan, we could have a worldwide almost
Lebanon.
Chaos developing in throughout the entire Middle East. And in large part,
Algeria,
due to our policies
in the past and in the present. Now listen.
You know, it's pretty hard.
The Arabs have had dictators since the inception of the British and the French installed their kings, and now they have either kings or dictators who overthrew their kings. So to say it's all America's fault, I think, is a little strong.
Fine. Well, no, I'm just
talking Mubarak.
I'm right about that. I'm just talking about current history. We can go back for decades, yeah, and show the problem, and it's been a problem.
We did not support Syria's dictator. You can't pin that one on us.
I'm talking about the whole picture. I'm not talking about Syria specifically.
Frankly,
the whole picture has been sustained by us and by our policies and by, frankly, our greed.
It has been. I think it depends country by country. We did support Egypt's dictator. We did not support Syria's dictator. We supported Iran's dictator to 1979.
We haven't supported their dictators from 79 to 2011. We supported in Egypt. You know,
I mean,
we supported in Egypt. Anybody could keep the Suez Canal open.
And so did the British. Let me say this. And I mean, it's so important, I'm going to say it twice. Our past hypocrisy and our past mistakes should not prevent us from doing the right thing in the future. I want to repeat that. Our past hypocrisy and our past mistakes should not prevent us from doing the right thing in the future.
And you're assuming that we know what the right thing is. Talk about hubris.
Well,
holy cow.
Let's start with the things I think you and I can agree on, Terry. You can agree we should shut down our embassy in Syria and get the heck out of there. I think you could agree with me on that.
Yep.
And I think you can agree with me that we need to sanction the Syrian government.
Yeah.
Okay. So those
which
basic steps...
Which usually punishes the people, but go ahead.
Those basic steps, which President Obama appears to be taking...
You know, all those
You
steps-
and I agree... have to be taken.
I don't know even. I mean, I really am at a loss. I'm not claiming one side or the other. You know, we put all these sanctions on Iran. Has it hurt the Iranian leadership any at all? No, they've just transferred all of their funds and all their investments to Russian banks and some other banks that don't give a damn. So nothing has been changed, really.
Yeah, but see, Terry, I think...
You know, I don't know the answer, and I don't think...
I think that you and I, on domestic issues, on foreign policy issues... Sometimes I think, and you can give it back to me if you disagree.
Me?
Sometimes I think you and I agree on the problem. I come up with solutions that are imperfect and the best that my febrile mind can come up with. and you say, that's not good enough, that's not good enough, that's not good enough, but I don't hear your own solutions. And then you just describe the problem.
Oh, no, in this case, you're definitely wrong. And, you know, I don't think
you have an answer.
I don't. That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
I do not have
an
answer.
So I'm at least trying.
That doesn't make your answer any good, Mark.
No, there are no good answers.
It doesn't make your answer right.
There are no good answers. There's the least worst answer.
The least worst
answer.
That's
what I'm struggling for.
The problem is, you know, which the one thing Americans never want to do is get the UN involved and give up some of our sovereignty and realize that we need
the
international community to solve
international
problems.
Well, hold on, Terry. Isn't that what we did in Libya? Isn't that exactly what we did in Libya? We got the UN involved. We got a resolution of the Security Council.
No, but we
got NATO involved.
Are we doing
that? What are you complaining about now?
You brought up Syria. Are we doing that with Syria?
I'm telling you, I would do that with Syria, absolutely. And I think Obama's doing it. I think
part of that. Part of that is my point, Mark, and this is my only point, because I don't pretend to have the answer. I'm not going to pretend to have the answer. But unless we get some organization, something like the UN involved in this, and let the international community create the answer, it ain't going to work. Because there's no answer that American hubris can come up with that's going to win something.
But my point
good
is,
for the
Terry,
people.
And
what I'm talking about is for America to get a little bit of friggin' humility.
Look, Libya happened first. Syria's happening now. But it looks to me like we're going down the same route. I think Obama is going to the United Nations.
I hope so.
I think he is going to seek sanctions. I think he is going to withdraw our diplomatic personnel. And he is looking for the international community to sanction Syria. My point
is... one thing I will really praise Obama on...
He's an internationalist.
Hesitant.
You like that.
In this situation, being hesitant is necessary. You got to get a lot of information. You got to get a lot of opinions. You got to get a lot of facts before you take any action, because this is not a simple situation.
But, you know, you can hesitate for too long. In Rwanda, we waited too long.
In Congo, we are still waiting.
In Bosnia, we waited too long. In Darfur, we waited too long. I'm not saying don't be careful. He should be careful. He is being careful. But there comes a point when careful becomes inaction. And I never want to take that point because I am ashamed of our lack of intervention in Darfur, Rwanda, and Bosnia.
No, see, but what you're saying is it should be our action. And what I'm saying is, no, it has to be international action.
I am fine with seeking international action. That's exactly what Obama's doing. That's what he did in Libya.
Then we're in total agreement.
But I think you're still complaining about Libya,
even though he did Libya the right way. I think we have no choice to cancel the Raucous Caucus because you and I are in total agreement.
No, well, I want to know if you think Obama did Libya right. He did international, he did NATO, he did UN, he did it all by Terry's book, didn't he? Can he get a little praise for Libya?
Let me put it this way. I don't disagree with what he did. I think he was naive, or let me put it this way, the presentation to the American people, again,
that was lousy. I'll agree
naive.
That was lousy.
You know, it is war you're getting involved in. Now we have drones going in there.
Right.
You know.
Are you okay with that?
It's escalation.
Are you okay with it? Because I am. I want to get a definite answer from Terry D. Kester.
I'm only okay with it if the international community is involved. America cannot solve the problem. They can impose a solution, but they cannot solve the problem.
Terry, I don't think there is such a thing as the international community. I don't think it exists. I think
Maybe we ought to start to look for one.
I think Britain and France support escalation. I think Russia and China are against escalation.
Yeah.
I think Qatar supports escalation. I think Turkey is against escalation. I think whenever you say the international community think that the world all holds hands,
sooner or later, we've got to give up our hypocrisy. You know, you're claiming all of this at the same time in Bahrain. They're, you know, creating chaos, but that's the home of the Fifth Fleet, so we don't give a damn about what they do
in Bahrain.
But
you're saying that because
do whatever you want.
What you're saying is, you expect anybody
in the Middle East to trust us,
Terry?
How could they?
Because we look.
I
wish we could have gone and helped the people in Tiananmen Square, but I recognize that would have been a very bad thing to do because China is a very powerful country. But my heart went out to them. I felt for them. I did not want them
to be crushed.
You're
comparing China and Bahrain.
What I'm saying is that because we can't help people everywhere does not mean we can't help people anywhere. Because we haven't been perfect everywhere in the past doesn't mean we can't do better today. What I think you're giving us is a recipe for inaction all the time.
No. International community, admitting that America does not have the answers for these Muslim Arab countries.
But the Arab League said go in.
The
Arab League said go in, and the Arab League is starting to condemn even Syria, which is surprising.
Fine. Build on that. Build on the international community.
That's
build
what
on
we did. That's
but
what we did.
Don't
so
make
can I get
assumption.
Some praise from my president on Libya? Did he do okay in your book?
I don't know yet.
It's so rare to hear you praise President Obama.
Hey, I praised him in the show in the very beginning, talking about America has to decide what kind of country it wants to be.
All right.
And this is part of that debate, too.
Okay, I'm glad to hear a little bit of praise, because I think the last time you praised President Obama is when he was candidate Obama.
I praised him when I voted for him. What more do you want?
I think everyone you've ever voted for, Terry, you've held your nose before you voted.
No.
Who did you vote happily for?
McGovern?
You bet. I guessed it right.
You bet. You're damn right.
George McGovern in 72.
Yeah, and I would again.
How well did he do? I think he won a state in the District of Columbia.
What can I tell you? Eugene McCarthy I would have voted for. Bobby Kennedy I would have voted for. Many people I would have voted for. Well, rather than those who just jump in and play the same game again, no. I'm bored with
that game. I'll tell you this. I fully recognize all the mistakes we've made in the past in foreign policy. I did not support the war in Iraq. I would bring our troops home from there. I don't think we can win in Afghanistan. I would bring our troops home from there. But I am not willing to say that we should not exercise our military might. Sometimes, and I think Rwanda, Bosnia, and Darfur, I think successfully in Kosovo, I think today in Libya, there are times when we, along with the international community, in concert with the international community, and it's never going to be all of them because they're never going to all agree with us, but England and France and Italy and Qatar and the Arab League and the people of Libya personally calling for us to help, that's enough for me. And frankly, if Syria gets to the point, and it's not there yet, but if it gets to the point that whole areas of Syria, the people liberate themselves the way it did in Libya, I'd be willing to help there too.
I think Syria's already at that point.
I don't think it's like Benghazi. Benghazi was a free city. The people freed themselves. I don't think they're quite there yet. But one of the interesting things that we're learning...
I'll tell you one thing that I really do feel very strongly, Mark. And that is what we've got to do more than anything else, and what all commentators, including ourselves, have got to do is realize the incredible, incredible complexity of these situations.
Well, that's true.
And there are no simple answers. There are no, quote, right answers. There are only efforts
least
that
worst
can be
answers.
Made. Not even least. There's just efforts we can make with a lot of hope.
Right.
A lot of hope. But
and all these
no
people that are saying,
answers.
Well, what's Obama's exit strategy? Well, you know what? To say there's an exit strategy requires perfect information.
That's a silly question. That's
it
a question
is.
That started because we couldn't solve the problem of Vietnam. And
right.
we still haven't solved the problem of Vietnam. And we haven't faced the problem of Vietnam. You don't go into any war with an exit strategy. What the hell is that? You go into war to win. That's it.
That's right.
So let's not kid ourselves and play these silly didactic games.
I'll tell you something, though. One of the things we've learned, and that Syria has learned very clearly, is that you can't allow the media into your country while you're massacring your people.
It's not a good idea.
And that's why the United States could kill 25,000 people in Hama. That's why the Algerians could massacre tens of thousands. But with YouTube, with iPhones, with this technology and Facebook, we're finding that Libya tries to control and they can't. Syria tries to control and they can't.
Brave Syrians and Libyans are
helping fight their own battles.
That's something important, and this may be the hopeful part of this, even though there's a lot of pain and tragedy involved with it. The social media... So far, not controlled by too many governments, so far, but it's getting iffy.
They try to shut it down.
Well, they're trying in America to get control of it, too. But anyway, the point is the social media has caused a really sea change in the world. And it may have a momentum and a power beyond anything that we can or can't do. And in some ways, that's what I hope for.
I don't think the social media is so much changed the world as exposed the world. People say people say that when you're drunk, you're not really changing. You're just expressing that part of yourself that you don't always show to the world. What I think social media has done is shown Syrians that other Syrians oppose their government, has shown Libyans that other Libyans oppose their government, has shown the courage of, because it's hard to be courageous alone and probably foolhardy. You'll end up getting yourself killed, but you can be courageous with 100,000 of your own fellow citizens.
And you can reach out to other countries and find out that other people care about what you're doing as well.
That's true.
I mean, it is revolutionary. Maybe that's the revolution that's more important than any of these political ideas.
Well, we have to wrap it up.
We do?
Again, this is Mark Levine.
And Terry D. Kester.
And it was the Raucous Caucus, WPFW 89.3 FM. We are on every Tuesday night. We'll be back next Tuesday at 7 p.m. in studio. If you want to call in, you can give us your two cents.
I will be out of town. So it's
fine.
So
Garland and me will
you,
have
you
fun.
And Garland
and I will have fun without
just
you.
Just have to get humble and have a quiet show.
We'll just have fun without you. Okay. You can Facebook either Terry DeKester or Mark Levine. Stay in touch, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you.